You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to get back today to our talk about Arctic and the Arctic in a moment. But first, this week the Senate voted down legislation put forward by Senators John McCain and Joseph Lieberman, a Republican and a Democrat, that would have put limits on U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in the hopes of taking steps against global warming. And the vote was the first time in years that Congress has brought the issue to a vote. But some states and local governments aren't waiting around for the national government to act one way or another. Joining me now is Casey Golden. He's policy director of a group called Climate Solutions that advocates action now and is working with a coalition of states in the Northwest to develop climate-related policies. From 1999 to 2002, Casey was a special assistant to Seattle Mayor Paul Schell for clean energy and climate protection initiatives. He was also a director of energy policy for the state of Washington from 1996 to 1999. He joins us by phone. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
How much rumbling is there out there in the country, locally, to get something done, to put some caps on carbon dioxide release?
There's more than rumbling. We're moving ahead with climate policies and clean energy policies in the states and at the local level. And we see a big opportunity in this kind of policy development to build our clean energy economies and build healthier communities and stronger local economies. And we see no point in waiting for federal action to do it.
But can you have much of an effect on the total picture if you're just a few states? How many states are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about the three West Coast states. 10 states in the Northeast are capping carbon emissions from power plants. If you take just New York and California collectively, you've got the world's fourth largest economies. And even many just average-sized U.S. states are major greenhouse gas polluters on a global scale. So this state action is significant in its own right and surely significant for building momentum toward national action in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the approaches toward the capping? Are they auto emissions? Are they coal-burning plants? What's the range here?
In the Northeast states, they are negotiating a cap on CO2 emissions from their power plants. In the West Coast states, Oregon and Washington are both implementing rules to limit global warming pollution from new power plants. And California is taking the landmark step of limiting global warming pollution from cars for the first time. But maybe even more importantly, these states are really starting to take active steps toward building the kind of clean energy alternatives and energy efficiency alternatives that will provide the alternative sources of energy that can replace fossil fuels and also help clean the air in our communities.
The New York Times had an article on this effort this week, and it pointed out that there were six states, Alabama, Illinois, Kentucky, Oklahoma, West Virginia, and Wyoming, that have explicitly passed laws against any mandatory reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. They've gone just the opposite way. How do you react to that?
Well, I think they're missing the boat. I think the energy economy of the future is going to belong to those who build their clean energy sources and who use energy more efficiently. You know, our dependence on fossil fuels isn't just creating global climate change. It's also draining our economy. It's exposing us to security risks. And it's fouling the air in our communities. So I think the states that are looking forward and starting to position themselves for success as we make the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy sources are the states that are going to come out ahead.
Are you looking for a critical mass, enough states that would force some national action in Congress?
You know, I think if this builds momentum for national action, that's terrific. But fundamentally, what we're trying to do is build healthier communities, build stronger economies, reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, and build the foundation for a clean energy future in our states. And, you know, many of the important decisions that affect how we use energy, how much energy we use, what kinds of energy we use, really are made at the state and local level. So, you know, I don't want to say that we don't need national action. There's no substitute for the largest national carbon polluter in the world starting to take effective action. But in the meantime, we hope to invite that kind of federal leadership by moving ahead on solutions and demonstrating that they work and that they help us achieve our local goals.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Of course, one of the major states you mentioned, California, that was getting cooperation in that effort from Governor Gray Davis, who, of course, who's been voted out. You have any indication how the governor-elect Schwarzenegger is going to pick up that baton?
Governor-elect Schwarzenegger has reaffirmed his commitment to the landmark law in California that will limit greenhouse gas pollution and global warming pollution from automobiles, and we have every sign so far that he's committed to this agenda. Again, in part because he believes in it, I think, environmentally, but also in part because California senses real economic opportunity in being a pioneer and a leader in the kinds of clean energy technologies that are going to replace fossil fuels and ultimately help us stop global warming.
Casey, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Many thanks to you, Ira.
Casey Golden is Policy Director for Climate Solutions, a climate advocacy group based in Olympia, Washington. We're talking this hour, switching back gears to Arctic ice and the thinning of the ice in the Arctic regions. My guests are James Morrison of the University of Washington, Seymour Laxon, University College London, and Mark Serez, University of Colorado in Boulder, our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Morrison, I want to turn to something that you mentioned early on, and that was a change in the salinity. Did I catch that? Also the salinity of the seawater in the Arctic?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, the largest and earliest indication in that direction is actually a change in the distribution of salinity. The Atlantic Ocean is saltier by about 10% than the Pacific Ocean, and the two big oceans meet and essentially mix in part in the Arctic Ocean. The Pacific water comes in through Bering Strait, and the Atlantic water comes in through Fram Strait. So they're in there in sort of a big boxing ring, having a match. And what happened in the early 90s was that the share of the Arctic Ocean, the upper Arctic Ocean, that the Atlantic occupied, increased. And it swung around, and the boundary sort of swung around in a counterclockwise fashion. So that was the dominant change. There's also been a tendency that Mark alluded to freshen things in the Arctic. And this is where we see this wonderful interplay between the land and the ocean in part, because we've seen a runoff increase, the amount of water that comes down the major Russian rivers especially, increase over the last, 50 years. And I think it amounts to about 7% over that time. Hmm. And there's suggestion that basically the global water cycle is accelerating, that you're getting more evaporation in the ocean and more water vapor in the air, and it's more of it's coming down in the high latitudes. The Arctic, in a way, is sort of a big catch basin. I think it only has maybe 5% of the world's ocean, but it drains 10 or 15% of the Earth's land. So it's very sensitive not only to temperature change, but I think it's sensitive to changes in this water balance. Mm-hmm. So there's been a general freshening.
Mm-hmm. Do you buy the theory that, but maybe buy is the wrong word, there's been talk that perhaps one of the major consequences if there is a major melting, not just of the polar, of the North Pole, but the Southern Polar region, especially Antarctica, which holds so much of that fresh water, that there would be changes in the Gulf Stream, the salinity of the Gulf Stream, that would prevent it from getting up into Europe and collapsing their economy and creating global freezing, global wintering instead of global warming?
Well, I think that, yeah, that's a spectacular idea that's come out, and I think it's one that we really fascinated by. It's sort of the idea that, well, you could have global warming, and yet in some places this would result in the deep freeze. Mm-hmm. And I think that that issue is actually a lot murkier than many of these other ones, because the meridional overturning circulation is pretty complicated, and it's not clear if we shift the polar front, for example, shift that northward if the convection regions would shift with it, or if other mechanisms would tend to drive the overturning circulation. So there's really quite a bit of debate over that, and I'm afraid I don't have an answer for you, and it's not because I have any axe to grind, it's just I'm confused myself. But
I'm not going to try to put you in a box to say something you're confused about. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We learned a long time ago that it's okay for scientists to be confused themselves.
I think I'd like to support Jamie in this. I mean, I think it is an incredibly complicated system that we're looking at here, and you know, the fact is that, you know, we were trying to gather as much data as possible, but there's still an awful lot we don't know about this system. And I think the only way we're really going to learn things is by, you know, a lot of these results about the Gulf Stream switching off come from models. But as well as advances in models, we need the observations to be able to check that the models are properly predicting what's going on today. Data both in situ and of course, wonderful satellite measurements as well, combining these things with models and integrating, getting an integrated system. And I think by doing that, we can have some, you know, just as with the local weather forecast, you know, we've improved the accuracy of weather forecasts now, you know, where it used to be, we can now predict sort of 4 or 5 days in advance, where as well as we a few years ago we could only predict a couple of days in advance. So I think we have to try and work towards that sort of advance in our understanding. But I agree with Jamie, it is a difficult question at the moment, and I wouldn't feel qualified to answer it myself.
Of course, if you err on the wrong side of the equation and you wait too long saying we don't have enough information to do, you know, it doesn't pay to do something about it, then, and it happens, you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, well, well, that's right. We can just do what we can do.
Okay. Mark, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I just wanted to comment on this thing of waiting too long. You know, surely there's a great deal of controversy regarding whether humans have indeed had an impact on climate. We do know some things. We know that the carbon dioxide levels today are quite high. If you look at evidence from ice cores, it seems that the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere today are the highest they've been in probably 400,000 years, okay? So certainly we've changed the atmosphere in this way. It seems quite clear. And but, you know, have we seen the change yet? Have we seen the climate change yet? My view on this has always been that the issue of climate change or of human-induced climate change, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. You know, have we seen the changes yet? We keep loading the atmosphere with greenhouse gases and other things.
All right.
The climate will change. It's pretty much inescapable.
Yeah. All right.
I agree wholeheartedly.
I'm going to have to end it on that. So thank you all for joining me. Jamie Morrison of University of Washington, Seymour Lacks University College London in UK, and Mark Serres, University of Colorado in Boulder. Thank you all for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Before we go, though, we're going to have a little surprise, a sound from space. I want you to listen to this. This is the sound of one of those solar flares that we've been bombarding the Earth recently, and it was recorded by the Cassini spaceship, a spacecraft probe on its way to Saturn. This is what it sounds like. That was it. That little peak there was the sound of electrons that were shooting out from, moving out from the solar flare at high frequency, but dropping to a low frequency. Interesting sound from space that was produced by the University of Iowa's Dr. Don Gurnett, who supplied that to us. Our program is produced by Annette Heiss, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and also our web producer. If you missed any thing we talk about, you will surf over to our website at Science Friday's Kids Connection. We have free curricula there made for students and teachers. We also have our archives on audio, and you can download them in your Audible player or listen to them in real audio. And also send us email there, and also links about the program are all there for you to enjoy during the week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.